Hey, welcome to Big Jim's Garage. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Everybody calls me Big Jim. Just hanging out, man. So today, a little different. One of my favorite people in the world. And the greatest living race car driver? Yeah, I think so. Mario Andretti. When I'm doing a Zoom session with him, we're going to talk everything from Formula One to IndyCar. And how come he never drove for Ferrari? He did some, but never F1. It's a great conversation. Of course it is. It has nothing to do with me. It's him. It's Mario Andretti in Big Jim's Garage.
Thanks.
Wonderful. Detroit is wonderful, and it's good to have racing back. And good timing with Fernando Alonso coming back. See, I have this all planned out, Mario.
I know. Good. Fresh news.
How good of a driver is he? As a fan, I mean, I appreciate him, but as a driver, how good is he?
You look at his background, obviously, you know, former world champion, and then when he decided to venture into other series, such as his first experience at Indianapolis with Michael Steam, I think he was pretty darn impressive. You know, it's something quite new, first time on an oval, and then of course he pursued the you know, the Le Mans program, and it was the right time because, you know, Toyota was just the car to beat for sure, and all he worried about is his own team. But nevertheless, you know, he's a complete driver. He's very ambitious, as you can see. You know, he was looking to satisfy other parts of his career, you know, rather than just his specialty. And it's something I personally recognize with, because I felt the same way. It's primarily, you know, he's a Formula One driver, but, you know, he had more ambitions than that. And now the good news is, I think, for the sport in general and a lot of the fans, is the fact that he is, you know, he's rejoining Formula One. And with Renault, I think this works very well for Renault, especially because Fernando makes a lot of noise, good noise, on social media. You can see even in virtual racing, you know, right. He is very much involved in that. And again, he's a good guy besides, but very talented indeed.
So when I look at him and I see him in the different disciplines of racing and I think about your career, what was it that was there ever a point where you're like, I just want to do this? Or were you always seemed so open to anything with four wheels, you were ready to go?
Well, here's the way I looked at it, Jim. I mean, you always have to have a primarily commitment to the season, which is basically your specialty. And mine was always either IndyCar or Formula One. But for me, it was never enough as far as even the amount of races for the season. You know, when I was running sprint cars and midgets, I was doing, you know, up to 30, 40, 50, 60 races a year. And then, so whenever there was a weekend open, you know, even when I was doing Indy cars, if I had an opportunity to do sports cars or something like that, I would do it, and vice versa. Even, or stock cars, you know, I didn't do a lot of stock cars, but I did some. Actually, I did more stock cars than a lot of people think, because way back, like in the 60s, USAC had a stock car series, which was actually parallel to NASCAR, the same basic cars, rules wise. And I did some racing there. Actually, one of the stars in that series was always, you know, was like Pernelli Jones, for instance, and so forth. And I drove some of the Hallman and Moody cars in some NASCAR races, I mean, USAC stock car races. Which actually was fun to do in so many ways, because I ran some stock cars on dirt, even, you know, USAC stock cars on dirt, and so I was able to pretty much branch out and experiencing it at all. I love my sports prototype activities, Can-Am. You know, whatever was running out there, you know, I just wanted to be part of it. to fill the schedule. Sometimes even my wife would say, well, you know, we have a weekend off coming up. I said, well, not really. I said, did you have to book another race? Well, yeah, I think I did.
So we're talking about the Formula One season getting underway, and it was a really entertaining race, but it was weird. And I kept going back. The thing I couldn't comprehend, and maybe I'm missing this, when Hamilton hit Albon, when he hit him in the side, he was in full lock on the inside. It was as far as he could turn it. However, I always assume a driver of Hamilton's caliber knows exactly where that car is going. So if he decides to come out a little bit, is that intentional or am I just reading too much into it?
This is an area where I have some issues with, you know, as far as, you know, some of the officiating, they're treating sometimes, and I might be criticized for this, but I'll say it. Sometimes they're treating Formula One like it's you know, Skippy Barber series or something like that, because sometimes you have to sort of force the issue a little bit. But if it's just pure racing, hard racing, and there's contact, you know what? That's part of it. That's what makes it exciting. And to be able to punish, put this, you know, 5-second penalties, you know, on these drivers, the one that sticks into me that I'll never, ever be able to forgive, these, what they call these track officials? What they? Oh, the stewards.
The stewards.
Stewards, yes. To take the Grand Prix of Canada away from Sebastian Vettel last year, yeah, was a fallacy. And there's no way that was warranted. I mean, he overshot the chicane, the right left a little bit, but he did not put Lewis in danger. Lewis did not really complain. And then to give him a 5-second penalty for that. So sometimes if it's really, really flagrant, of course, yes.
Right.
Dangerously flagrant. But if it's hard racing, I think you have to let it go, you know, because there's not enough overtaking, you know, to satisfy the fans in general anyway. So don't put the cloud, a dark cloud over these drivers, you know, oh, should I try? Shouldn't. Just go for it. And, but sometimes they over police some of the driving, and these are the, you know, the best in the world, and you know, let them have at it.
And I, when you have new tires, and I heard Christian Horner say that the only way they could get around them was in corners. But new tires are new tires. I would assume you've got better entry speed as well, and you can drive in deeper into a corner. So that wasn't the only place he could have passed it.
I know, but at the same time, as I say, you still don't keep these drivers from, you know, being aggressive, is what I'm
right.
saying. That's
right.
What it's all about. That's the show. You know, if they have to be so absolutely correct, you know, it takes away. So these guys did take care of themselves, you know, obviously. And if there's some dispute, let them work it out, you know, after the race or something like that, or at the driver's meeting. But like I said, unless it's really, really flagrant, the stewards should just, you know, just mind their own business.
Did you ever have, you always hear in NASCAR, you always say, let's go meet in a trailer somewhere and talk about it. Did you ever have a moment like that with a driver where we're just going to go talk about this, talk, I'm doing the air quotes, after the race?
Yeah, I had moments, yes. In fact, I had moments even with AJ one time. And as a matter of fact, it was a double... you know, there were stock cars in Ducoin, Illinois. There were stock cars and champ cars the next day, stock cars on Saturday. And AJ and I really got together. Like, you know, he tried to squeeze me. There was Don White was stuck on the inside guardrail, and he tried to squeeze me down, and I whacked him, you know, and AJ went into the guardrail. So he and I just punched each other a little bit, you know, and then we basically destroyed our cars, and they were belonging to the same drive, to the same team. and then the next day we were at the driver's meeting for the champ cars, and I'm looking at him and he's looking at me, And I said, we better talk this out, you know. And we did. You know, we figured, okay, all right, you know, we had our dispute, but let's not mess around, you know, with the open wheel car and all that. And so among drivers, you can work these things out. If you have, you know, if you have an issue, you know, something that's not, you know, technically dangerous, you know, we can work it out. You know, so again, sometimes the stewards, I think they overdo things a little bit. And that's my pet peeve, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes.
I think for most fans, it is too. We don't, just like any sport, I don't want the referees to decide the game in any sport, especially
Amen.
Racing.
Yeah. Amen.
That's what they're there. You know what got lost in all this? I mean, Bottas drove an amazing race. But Charles Leclerc, to do what he did, as Ferrari was on the back foot all weekend, that's an amazing piece of driving that people understand. That was pretty impressive. And you've been talking about him for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's very true. Actually, Charles, he was very happy with himself, too, because he knew how far he had to reach throughout the race to keep it up there. And again, he did everything right, and it paid off, obviously. I don't think he had a second place car, quite honestly, that day.
Yeah.
But he made it that way, and there was a lot of great things. Of course, you know, some technical issues, and then it was you know, with McLaren on podium. That's a big shot for the big, you know, a shot in the arm for the team too, as far as the energy they need, you know, at the start of the season. There, everybody's expecting them, you know, to just have, you know, to be competitive now, to at least right. For podium, and they accomplished that. There were a lot of things that are unusual, you know, some mechanical failures, a lot of it electrical failures and so forth, which unfortunately sideline, you know, like Max Verstappen, for instance, yeah. Who was definitely a player. You know, in the race, and as you say, I big kudos to Bottas, because I mean he drove impeccably. I mean, not only put the car on pole, but man, I mean he was 10 tenths to stay ahead of Lewis. You know, which Lewis had DRS. You know, there was a DRS in three places there in Austria, and he was able to fend him off. That was a great job. He really deserved that win.
Mentally, is it harder on I know you want to be in front, obviously, but mentally, is it harder on the driver in front when you're being pushed by somebody because you know you've got to hit your marks? You have no air. There's no wiggle room.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's when the pressure is on. I mean, you know, when you're following, obviously, you can judge yourself, breaking points. You can try to inch up on your competitor, you know, but you have a guideline. You have somebody in front of you. But right. When you're up there on your own, you don't want to overdo it. You know, you overdo it, and obviously that you're going to be overtaken. So, and that's, to me, it shows really the quality of the driver when they're able to be hit their mark, make no mistake when they're under just extreme pressure. And says something, says volumes about the talent of the driver.
I was, we were talking, we were watching the NASCAR race when they had the accident in pit lane, which thank God that guy wasn't more seriously injured, the Jack Van. But our producer here, younger guy, Ryan, Mario, he had never seen Gordon Johncock's last pit stop at Indy in 82 when he was doing, 190 miles an hour when he hit pit lane. That's not real. It looks cartoonish. I mean, you did it. What is it like when you're trying to pit going that fast coming in there and people are off to your left and it's not a wide pit lane anyway?
No, I know. It's like I said, the speed limit is a good thing in the pit lane, because obviously when it was open, I used to practice that during tire tests. You know, sometime I would just come in flat out of turn four, flat, and just back off just as I hit the pit entry, and then just just try to gather it all up and hopefully stop where you need to stop at your own pit. But it was kind of it was crazy, actually, because that was probably the most dangerous part of the track. And so the introduction of the pit speed was really a good thing, believe me.
Was it? Yeah, I can't. So he was doing 190, wasn't he? That was. Is that sound about right?
All of it, absolutely.
Who's coming over the wall first when you're coming in that fast?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody's probably gonna kill 40 mechanics. You know what I mean?
So. I always thought you love. If you're the right front guy, you're screwed. Yeah, you're the guy. You go first. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, how far did you slide the car then? Because the rules, I assume, were differently then. You could come in through an extra box if it was in front of you, or you had to still kind of line it up and slide the car in.
Well, I think, yeah, you could just slide halfway into the next box and then still, you know, to get pushed back. But again, you didn't want to do that, obviously, because, you know, everything you thought you gained by coming in so fast, you lose on the other side. So it was everything calculated, you know, sliding in there just right, which, again, you know, most of the time there were mistakes made and dangerous ones. So, again, that's one area that, you know, that the rules really plays, you know, positive role.
I was watching the IndyCar race, obviously, and it was interesting that, like, when you watch Formula One, and I remember we all complained about the halo when it first came out. It looked like a sandal and blah, blah, blah. We understood the safety purposes. And then the canopy for the IndyCars, same idea. But I realize now I actually like the F1 because I can't see the driver anymore in IndyCar. I don't see them in there. I if you didn't tell me, it could be a drone driving around. I miss being able on some level to see that helmet and know that person's in there.
Well, you know, it's probably not the correct thing for me to say, but because I'm not active, but I think the halo would have been a better answer. I think they found out at, you know, even at the road race, which is actually the first actual road race they had at Indianapolis, that the heat factor was really, really, you know, an issue. And some other places, I think it might be even worse. So I know they're trying really hard to ventilate, you know, the cockpit, the ambient area there. But I think there are other issues rather than just what you're saying, hiding the driver, so to speak. I don't know. I mean, it's safety features are always good. I mean, sometimes some safety features are safe for one thing, but they can create other issues. I think the halo might have been a better all-around situation, but, you know, it is what it is.
We'll see what happens. I was thinking about you too, Mario. First of all, I got to order some wine. I was browsing the winery. I haven't ordered any wine yet, so I got to do that. What goes well with brisket? A red, a beef. What should I get?
For Pinot Noir.
Okay, go Pinot? Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Now, are you one of these, or are you like you're supposed to have red with red meat and white with fish, pork? Are you a separator or are you drink what you like?
No, for sure. I mean, the variety, there are certain varietals that complement, you know, different foods, obviously. The one good red varietal that's pretty much goes with, you know, with pasta and, you know, even chicken and salmon is Sangiovese. You know, it's really, it's very mellow. And, but then when you get to, you know, if you want to have a nice fish fry, then the chard is very good with that. But again, you know, a lot of it is your palate, you know, between cabs also, you know, for red meat or Merlots. It's whatever melts your butter, you know, that's what you got to go for.
Well, your, and if people haven't seen the documentary, it was wonderful. We talked about it before, but your family had a winery, had a vineyard before the war and everything happened. I don't know if I ever asked this. Was there any way to find any of the old vineyard at all to save any of it afterwards, like even some of the trees or roots or anything?
You mean the ones the family owned?
Yeah, the family ones.
Oh, that's, you know, I've been visiting that area, you know, over the years since, you know, since back in the 60s. I've been going back and forth, but I have no idea who even owns that. It was at the beginning. Right. It's, you know, the state that occupied our land, which was Yugoslavia, they owned all that land. We lost everything, you know, under Harlan Kamenev. That's what we left. But there's no way of knowing what happened to all the rest of it. I never had, you know, any follow up. As a matter of fact, my dad never went back there until back in, I think it was 1998. I think we went back. I took him back for the first time, you know, in the area where we left. So we didn't have much time to really travel around to show me exactly where the holdings were. So all of that is lost forever.
And I was thinking about you too, Mario, because I've been reading more reports that they're talking about doing a movie about Enzo Ferrari, which is like, what have they been waiting on? When was the first time you met Enzo?
First time I met Enzo was in 1969. I was doing the 1,000 Ks in Monza. Teamed up with Chris Amon. And that's the first time that I got to meet him face to face. And of course, I raced there. You know, I won in 70 for them at Sebring. And then in 71, I won my very first Formula One race for Ferrari. Then I visited the factory and actually offered me a job there, you know, the full-time Formula One, which I could not take because the commitments I had here, you know, with Firestone and so forth. I always dealt with him directly, which was not a usual thing. Usually he had someone, a buffer in between, like a Dr. Gozzi, who everybody knew well, Francolini to deal with the drivers until the final situation. But I consider those moments so precious, you know, that right to the very end, you know, I always had contacts. Even my very last race for Ferrari was in 82 when I substituted for Didier Pironi, you know, it was a terrible year for Ferrari, you know, by losing Gilles Villeneuve and then Didier Pironi substituted for Monza. And I always dealt with him, like I said, directly by phone. And again, I just consider that, you know, some of the highlights of my career, quite honestly, because of what Enzo Ferrari really represented for me, where I fell in love with motor racing, you know, because of Ferrari, basically, for what the role that they played in those formative years for me while I was still in Italy. And you know, my idol was Alberto Ascari, who was in the mid-50s current world champion and all of that. So it goes way back, you know, to some things like that, like dreams that came true for me, quite honestly. That's really what it represents.
He seems like everything that I've ever seen, and I go down rabbit holes with Enzo. I am, out of all the racing people that I've read about and been blessed to meet, obviously nowhere near you, Mario, but he's the one guy that everyone talks about with such reverence, and the fact that he owned whatever room he came into. He was just the guy. You knew who Enzo was. There was no BS between it. He was, I would assume, as direct as I've always heard.
It was amazing. I attended one of the press conferences that he would hold just prior to the season. I just happened to be there. And you know, press in Italy, pretty tough in right. So many ways. But as soon as you walk in the room, everybody really quiet and respectful. And he says, he would introduce him, you know, the team, you know, the all of what was going to go on for the following, for the coming season. And then they said, well, now the floor is yours. He said, shoot, but aim correctly.
I never knew that you were offered a Ferrari ride in F1. How did that must have, I mean, obviously you're a man of your word, so you stuck to, you know, with Firestone and here in the States, but didn't that tear you up at some level inside that you couldn't, that was your dream, wasn't it?
Well, Yes, it did. Like I said, the timing was just wrong for me. And, you know, there was in those days, quite honestly, even financially, you didn't do very well in Formula One. And things were really going well here for me. So I had to be thinking in those terms as far as, you know, the security of the family and everything else, the future. And I figured, okay, it's going to come around. And I almost joined Ferrari at the end of 77 again. And that one somehow, you know, didn't happen. You know, there's a long story about it. It's like in some ways now it's cute, you know. But again, the beautiful thing is that in 71, I win South Africa. And then I backed that off with a couple of weeks later in the non-championship race in Ontario, California. For the Questro Grand Prix, where they, you know, we ran 2 100-mile heats because they had Formula 5000 competing there. You had Foyt, the answer is actually Mark Donohue, and the full Formula One teams, and I won both of the 100-milers, and with Jackie Stewart finished second, which was big for me, obviously, and after that. Was invited at the factory, and in fact, he offered to give me the race car that I won those two races with. And I said, "Nah," I said, "I want to look at the your U.S. Assembly line, you know." So I looked at the Daytona in '72. You know, there was a '72 model coming on. I said, that's the one I like, you know. So I got a road car instead of a race car.
Did you ever meet John Surtees at all?
Oh yes, oh yes, yes. I'm just looking at a photo with John Surtees on my wall there. We were invited at the Mercedes 100th anniversary in Stuttgart, I'm looking at. Phil Hill, John Surtees, and Fangio, and myself right there on the wall.
But, you know, we talk about, like, we see the names Fangio and Ascari, and we talk about Jackie Stewart and you and Formula One and Schumacher and Vettel and all the big names and Hamilton. But I'm just now starting to learn more about John Surtees and understand. Didn't he win, like, Formula One and on two wheels as well in the same year?
Yeah, he was the double world champion, you know, yeah. He was world champion in bikes, you know, and like what it is MotoGP today.
Unreal. And then,
yeah, then he moved over to Formula One and he won there. Yeah. Great guy. Great, great guy, actually. And then he won some sports car races. I think he won some Can-Am races as well. He was very good in sports car, you know, pretty much a complete driver, period. I mean, not too many. The only one that I know at that level that competed at that level is Mike Hailwood. You know that he did some Formula One and then and MotoGP as well. But Surtees won the championship on both sides, which is amazing.
Well, he left Le Mans that year, the first year that Ford won, right? Wasn't he because they changed the driver lineup?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. To walk away, like I'm not doing this. His kind of character. He just seemed like one of those people that you too. I saw a lot of similarities the more I read about him. The ability just to get behind anything and figure it out pretty quick and go.
Amazing. Yeah, amazing talent. Yeah.
Well, there's so much going on right now. Is there something that NASCAR has been fun to watch? We miss the fans, obviously, but it's interesting to watch the young drivers sticking their nose back up there in IndyCar. You're seeing the young drivers kind of showing their – Scott Dixon was amazing, but I'm seeing these young guys stick their nose up there. And then Formula One, I don't remember a time when all three series, it almost feels like there's a changing of the guard coming pretty quick.
You know what? You're so right. But all three series have something very special to offer and things to definitely look forward to because you have some young talents here that actually make a lot of noise. And whether it's, you know, Formula One, I mean, let's look at Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen. I mean, no question, these are future world champions. And they're going to be there at every race. So you look forward to that. And then in NASCAR, I mean, I can't even begin to name all the young talents, you know, they're in Cup. And right. then in IndyCar, the same way. But then in IndyCar also you have the old guard that's still young. They're very right. young. I mean, you look at Will Power, you know, and Scott Dixon, you know, they're up there, you know, about to break records, you know, a couple of mine actually, and still young to do so, and yet they have, you know, look at the Colton Herta, what he did, like at the end of last year, what impressed me the most is at Laguna Seca, where he had two of the very best that. IndyCar has to offer on his tail the entire race, and he never put a wheel wrong, and he won it. I mean, pure speed. Yeah. I mean, and put the car on pole besides, you know. So again, it's going to be exciting, you know, as time goes on. And you know, I as a fan, I look forward to every race that's coming on, you know, with so much anxiety. But honestly. Because it's going to be entertaining, to say the least, and we need more of it. We need it so bad, yeah. You know, all of us have been just hunkering down, you know. But enough's enough. We got to get to work.
And I want to see George Russell behind the wheel. And I love Williams. I root for him, but I want to see what he can do behind the wheel of a competitive car.
Yeah, I think you got it. You got it right. Yeah, and I think probably if it wasn't. Fernando wasn't in the play, he might have got the ride for, you know, with Renault, the way I hear. But nevertheless, he's a talent that talent never usually never goes wasted, ultimately. So he'll get his break. He will. So, and then that's another thing to look forward to, quite honestly.
Family's good. Everybody's healthy. So with the coronavirus and all this, everyone's good?
Yeah, we're all good. Thank you. Yeah.
Perfect. What are you doing? Just sitting around? You can't. You don't strike me as the kind of guy who ever just sit around.
No, I don't sit around. I have a lot of things going, and we're zooming all over the world. But honestly, but the other thing is that I'm also, because of the time that I have that I wouldn't otherwise, you know, I started writing my memoirs. Not something that probably would have never happened because it takes quite a bit of time, you know, and reflection and so forth. So. I'm using some of the time to do that. How quickly I will do it probably take another couple of years to finish. But that's another thing that I thought that I would use the time, you know, to do that. Otherwise, it would have never happened.
So what are you going to write about Detroit, the Detroit Grand Prix through downtown? Just we had a bunch of potholes and manhole covers, or was that a fun race for you?
Oh, it's always great. I mean, I always love the, you know, the street races because that's a special challenge yeah. in every way. I mean, it's and the bumpier that it was, the better, because that's the area where you feel that somehow if you can deal with that, you have a chance to actually do a better job than somebody, at least in your own mind. Right. And I hate smooth tracks. I always did, whether it's oval. Road course, I like the bumps because I think the bumps, it really brings out the best in you because that takes, you know, a little bit extra skill to be able to negotiate. And I never had any problem except for that, you know, yeah, for the those covers to come loose or something that you didn't want to do that. But for the rest of it, I never complained about bumps.
So like the Nürburgring, even with all the oscillations and the seams and everything, that was never an issue for you?
No. No, the only thing there, like I said, it was the safety aspect. When I first drove the Nürburgring in 1969, they didn't even have any guardrails anywhere. You know, like if you went off, you hit some trees. And, well, Le Mans was the same there for a while in the 60s. But and that was the thing. But, you know, you didn't think about it at the time. You figured, well, I better not go off, you know. But the safety aspect, you know, was had a lot to be desired, left a lot to be desired.
You stay safe, you stay healthy, and all the best. And we'll be watching racing together. And if I don't say it enough, thank you for the time. And everybody loves it here in the Motor City and beyond. We get people to listen to these conversations all over the world, and you always make me think about something new, Mario. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jim. Thanks for having me.
All right. Be well. Take care.
There you go. Mario Andretti. As always, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the time. At Mario Andretti on Twitter. Check out his winery. It's Mario Andretti. Can't wait for that book, by the way. Neat stuff. Neat stuff. All right, wrapping up. Next week, obviously, we'll talk a lot about the Bronco, the unveiling of the Ford Bronco. I'll be here in Detroit, and hopefully I'm going to get some actual face time or wheel time or seat time with the Bronco for you guys next week. We'll check that out. They are all in against Jeep, man. This is going to be a very, very, very interesting debate when it comes to this. Curious to see how this goes. I guess that's it. Man, it's always fun talking to Mario. You can subscribe, obviously, B-Pod Studios. Anywhere you get your podcast, you can do that. And thank you. Thanks for spending some time with us today, man. Mario Andretti. Such a great guy. All right. You follow me on Twitter at WCSXJim. Thanks again. You guys be well.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.